Hi, this is Joan Hubbard Cousins. While building a cabin in the Alaskan wilderness during 1975, I ventured alone further into that trackless territory without food, map, or compass, and on the third day, realized I was lost.
We travel for business. We travel for pleasure. We travel to expand our minds, whether it's one state over or halfway around the globe. If the world's a book, why only read one page? I'm Elizabeth Hill, and you're listening to a WAMC Northeast Public Radio production. This is Postcards from the Road.
Feeling the familiar pull towards the magic of something new, I also felt hesitant to abandon my companion, the Chattanooga. Pausing, I looked downriver, upriver, and into the valley. There was no contest. Gingerly, I stepped through the valley's boggy gateway.
Joan Hubbard Cousins loves to explore wilder places, both inside and out. She joined me via telephone from Idaho to read her written work. The stories you are about to hear have been adapted from her nearly completed memoir, Hiding and Seeking, A Search for Belonging in Wild Alaska. She currently lives on the road with her wife, traveling with Rosie, their tiny home on wheels, whose solar panels give them the freedom to live near and explore wild parts of the natural world. This is Episode 6, Part 1, Lost.
Striding around the clearing we carved into the Alaskan wilderness just 4 months earlier, I knew I had to escape. The idea of building a cabin with other women 7 miles from the nearest road seemed so romantic. Felling trees, crafting them into a cabin, all with hand tools. I'd even fallen for DB, the most motivated builder among the women. They called themselves the Klondikes, and I became a Klondike too. But where had all the romance gone? When you're ready to drop from lugging and chopping on logs all day, and your body's covered with week-old sweat, sap, bug dope, smushed mosquitoes, and dirt, making love loses its luster. If bathing in the river wasn't such an ordeal, maybe we would have lived more like lovers than sisters. But getting clean was tons of trouble. Everything was tons of trouble. DB's hell-bent on finishing that cabin. It's understandable. She wants to live here. I'm not so sure I do. All she cares about is that cabin and Kath, her first woman lover, who's now building the pipeline and living with another woman. Well, I can't change DB or what I want, so I've got to change where I am. I'll go to town, see other Klondikes, have a hot shower and cold ice cream. But they'll want all the river news, and I'm not ready to talk about how rocky things are with DB. I've got to stop wanting anything from her. A smile, tender words, some act of kindness. I want out of this thing people call civilization. Our needed supplies list, nailed to a sapling, fluttered in the breeze, reminding me of the gallons of creosote and peanut butter I'd lugged in 50-pound packs 7 miles downhill and then crossing the river however I could. Because the nearest bridge was upriver, a 2-day paddle from here. Most everything got here on someone's back, mostly mine. DB's clueless what it takes to get stuff here. Well, it's time she finds out. I smile. I'm not going to Fairbanks. I'll get over my head trip alone in the woods. My craving to abandon DB before she abandoned me galvanized me. I began shoving things into my backpack. Army surplus sleeping bag and rain poncho, rope, hunting knife, folding handsaw, water bottle, matches. My hatchet? Too heavy. But it's my favorite tool. It's coming. Scanning for anything else, I saw a book I'd borrowed from my nearest neighbors who lived a mile downriver. The volume rested near the fire circle, the central part of our camp. We cooked, ate, got warm, avoided mosquitoes and rain, rolled cigarettes and joints, read stories, talked, planned, and argued there. Before stashing the book in our tent, I opened it to gaze at a photo of the book's subject, a simple spiritual woman in India called the Holy Mother. Our eyes were closed, long dark hair flowing across her white sari, serene as a pond on a windless day. If only I felt a smidgen of her peace, not the ceaseless chop of my inner bearing sea. Wrapping the book with plastic, I nestled it inside my down bag, knowing I wouldn't be alone, soothed me. That's all I packed that clear August day in 1975. Deciding to fast and have some kind of spiritual experience, I took no food. We had no maps or compass. Cell phones didn't exist. And I'd sold my .30-06 rifle that could kill a bear. Believing I had all the necessities, I flung the pack on my back and took one last look around. Our pup tent sagged. Our food cache, wedged between three spruce, sat 12 feet above ground. Before we enclosed the cache, a black bear climbed one support tree across 3-inch protruding spikes and ate 20 pounds of prunes. His trail was easy to follow. Heading for the river, I passed through our cabin site where DB straddled a 40-foot-long spruce, pulling the draw knife confidently. Its bark rose in long strips, curling as they fell to the ground. A branch snapped underfoot, and DB's torso jerked up in taut alertness, searching for bear. Instead, she saw me. "Where are you headed?" "Oh, I don't know. Upriver." There were no trails upriver beyond our blueberry bog, since the nearest cabin was a day's canoe trip upstream. Longing for DB to ask why I was leaving, I also feared any kindness might ignite my long, smoldering desire to feel wanted. "How long you going for?" "Don't know, maybe 2-3 days. Turning, I headed for the bog. After spending my first 25 years in East Coast cities and suburbs, I failed to comprehend the vastness of the wilderness I was walking into. Just an hour's paddle downriver, the Chattanooga River meandered through a wetland the size of Rhode Island. Adrian, one of the women helping us build, called, "Have a great trip!" Looking back just at her, I said in a warmer tone, "Thanks, I plan to." Striding into the woods, I wanted nothing except to disappear. Walking beside the Chattanooga, I felt comforted by its familiar, slow, smooth flow towards the Yukon. Locals never called Alaska's longest river the Yukon River. They always said the Yukon with the same myopic devotion of New Yorkers, referring to the city as if there were no others on Earth. As I got further from our camp, there seemed to be no other people on Earth, and I liked it that way. There were no cabins or trails in this part of the river, and canoers were rare. As each step took me deeper into the familiar protection of aloneness, a little excitement penetrated my anger. I wonder what's around the next bend. Focused on each step, I wanted this to be a walking meditation, not just a hike. Scanning the underbrush, I alternated between listening intently and singing, hoping to warn bears of my approach. Sometimes I had to leave the river, feeling my way around a bog or soggy permafrost. Thick rosebush thorns tore at my blue jeans, work shirt, and bare hands. Other times I battled through dense willow or alder, knowing a bear could be napping there. Sometimes I struggled to find secure footing along the steep embankment where the river gnawed at the shore. Athabascans had hunted, fished, and roamed here for generations, yet they left no visible scars, not like the pipeline. Poor river looks wild, clean, and free, but once the pipeline crosses her next year, a leak will turn the water from see-through brown to black. Seems strange now that I focused on the river and not my own predicament. I was in deep wilderness, yet oblivious to its dangers. At 28, in the beauty and excitement of the moment, I had no inkling that I was making dangerous choices again. After tripping over a tangle of roots in the darkening light, I found a relatively flat spot by the river where I spread my sleeping bag on a bed of spruce needles. I had no tent to put up or dinner to cook. There are advantages to traveling light. Digging a pit, I started a fire. Flames lunged, devouring everything within reach. Constant craving, like me, always wanting more, better, different. DB and Adrian were sitting around their fire, DB probably sharpening her hatchet and planning tomorrow, or patching her eyeglasses with an amber glob of spruce sap, or rolling her nightly cigarette. I stared at the fire, especially where it skirmished with the edge of darkness. I'd never slept outside without the protection of a tent or other people. My ears monitored every sound. I threw back my head, thrust my chest forward, and cast wolf-like howls into the night. Couldn't do this in a city. More howls scrambled over one another, taking on an urgency, shape-shifting from expressing freedom to venting anguish. When I first met DB, her brown eyes and white-toothed grin radiated wholesomeness. As we talked, I heard a restlessness, a drive to live beyond the confines of jobs and mortgages. She craved the freedom found in wildness. I knew I'd met my mate. We pored over topo maps. "Let's build a cabin and live here," DB said, pointing to a tiny green spot surrounded by glaciers and high mountains. I wondered about the logistics, yet said, "Sure, let's do it." We'd practiced building our cabin on the Chattanooga, only 7 miles from a road and 1 mile river to cross. We were felling trees before I realized the taproot of DB's heart still clung to Kath, her first love, who'd forsaken their summer romance to finish college in Fairbanks. From my belly, I felt, then heard, howls, deep sobs, and finally wailing over and over again. The unpeopled forest gave such freedom. I don't know how to let go, but I have to. Something drove me into the wild, not just to explore, but to cast my hopes on the funeral pyre of my desires. A raven pair cawed as the sun eyed me from across the Chattanooga the next morning. Waters running slow, heading for the Yukon and Bering Sea. Don't know where I'm heading today. I smile, love seeing what's round the bend, not drudging on some cabin I'll never live in. Cooped up with DB all winter? No way. She hates books. Says they're never lining the walls of her cabin. Had the gall to say that while staring right at the books in my cabin. If I couldn't read, I'd die from cabin fever. I scan the river, trees, and underbrush in every direction. Wish I still had my .30-06. Sure would feel safer. Henry said bears can sense if you have a gun, and they'll leave you alone if you're not armed. Bizarre. But those sourdoughs know tons you'll never find in books. Time to stop bellyaching and get my buns in gear. Unzipping the mummy bag, I sat up, stretched, and rubbed my eyes, puffy from last night's crying jag. I pulled on my boots and scrambled down the bank to fill my bottle with water the color of weak tea. Lounging beside the Chattanooga, I had breakfast, swigs of cold water, while glancing through the Holy Mother book I'd borrowed. Don't know what to think of this serene woman in a sari. Married at 5, didn't meet her husband, Ramakrishna, one of the India's most revered mystics, until her late teens, then lived like a nun, serving her husband and his disciples for 50 years. Let's see, that's no sex, but tons of cooking and cleaning. Yuck! In this bio, her disciples say she's proof you can live in the midst of turmoil and worry, yet still have inner peace. Now that part's interesting. Before breaking camp, I wiggled my fingers deep underneath the remains of my fire, feeling for hot spots. The earth was cool, but I threw more water on the ashes, just to be safe. I gazed gratefully at this spot, where I'd felt so vulnerable, yet survived, then continued upriver. While walking, I savored everything. Squirrels' alarm chattering, ravens air diving, beavers' tails slapping, and grasses dancing. Hours later, a small valley came into view on my left, its two ridges reaching towards me, covered with tufted vegetation. Feeling the familiar pull towards the magic of something new, I also felt hesitant to abandon my companion, the Chattanooga. Pausing, I looked downriver, upriver, and into the valley. There was no contest. Gingerly, I stepped through the valley's boggy gateway. As I gained elevation, the feeder stream grew more defined, leaving solid ground for walking. Once in the valley, I felt enchanted by its embrace. Towards the end of the day, I discovered a mammoth, flat rock, safe for fire. My second night was easier. A safe fire, almost full moon, and no tears. DB and Adrian were by their fire, but I preferred mine. Sleeping with my back to the rock, I felt safer and entranced. On the third day, I roamed deeper into the valley and around her ridges, seeing the territory from different perspectives. When I reached the top at dusk, thick clouds had moved in, making the sky still darker. I couldn't even see the white knobs on Murphy Dome. an Air Force surveillance radar station on top of a treeless 2,900-foot peak and the only landmark in a sea of rolling ridges. No worry, I knew how to get back to the river where I'd spend the night. Assuming I could tell the lay of the land by how it looked, I walked down the outer slope of the ridge's finger, thinking it would take me back to my river. Appearances, I learned, can be deceiving. It got darker, and I kept walking, thinking I'd soon see the Chattanooga. When it was too dark to walk, I lay under a spruce. After a few hours of sleep, I woke to rain falling on my face and sleeping bag. Its cotton-covered down would soon be a sodden heap. Leaping up, I huddled in the understory, shivering and waiting for light. Assuming the nearby stream would take me to the Chattanooga, I followed its flow. After stumbling through the lumpy terrain for an hour, I reached the riverbank, relieved I could finally build a fire to get warm and dry. But then I gazed down at the stream in stunned disbelief. It was smaller than the Chattanooga and running the wrong way. If only I made camp last night, real camp, not just throwing my sleeping bag under a tree, then I wouldn't be in this mess, cold, hungry, lost. Well, I'm not really lost. I just don't know exactly where I am. I walked for hours along this creek today thinking it would take me to the Chattanooga, but it didn't. Then I backtracked looking for where I came in on the creek, but I couldn't see any way to retrace my steps. Sure wish I'd marked a tree where I started following the creek. Then I could have found my way back. But I was too wet and cold and sleep-deprived, so I wasn't thinking clearly. Now I've got to get warm and dry. Lacking a tent, I sought protection under some spruce branches from wind, rain, and whatever else was wandering around wild. Besides, I felt more invisible, more secure, snugged up to this tree, the survivor of more winters at 60 below than I'd ever lived. After summer of selecting, felling, limbing, and peeling trees for a cabin, I used my tools with confidence, feeling them as extensions of my own hands. But the cold had siphoned off my hands' usual strength. I'd walked all day in the rain, and its chill bored through the rubber army surplus poncho that hung over my cotton work shirt. I'd just spent an hour trying to muster enough dry wood for a meager fire. Spruce burned hot and long, but it was so gnarled it was a bummer to split. The blade of my buck knife kept hitting one knot after another. I squatted over the fire pit I'd dug with my hands in a deep mat of vegetation. Several times that summer I'd watched from our cabin site on the Chattanooga as the dark clouds of distant wildfires drifted in from another isolated spot in the Alaskan bush. That's why I searched the dark chocolate earth for any roots that might secretly snatch my fire and carry it underground. When my fingers finally scraped along the gritty permafrost 4 inches down, I knew the pit was deep enough. I propped the freshly peeled branch in the fire circle so it leaned against the teepee of twigs I'd already collected and skinned. With so few matches, this had to light the first time. Stepping back, I assessed my handiwork. I built fires every day back at camp. We lived in a clearing and cooked everything over an open fire, so I knew how to pile kindling that would quickly transform logs into an enduring fire. You had to create just the right amount of contact and just the right amount of space. If branches were too close, they'd smother the fire. Too far apart, and they'd never spark each other. Kind of like relationships. Eyeing this kindling, I felt satisfied. Its connection and independence was balanced. I'd thrown matches into my pack just before leaving camp, but they were now soggy from the rain. Searching my pack's other pockets, I found a small metal 35mm film canister. Unscrewing its top, I discovered a dozen wooden matches I'd carefully cut shorter so they would fit inside the waterproof container. They'd been in the bottom of that pocket for so long I couldn't remember when I'd put them there. Finally, I could dry my clothes. Tomorrow, I'd figure a way out of this wilderness.
You'll be able to hear the conclusion to Joan Hubbard Cousins' Alaskan Journeys next week on Episode 7, Part 2, Found. Postcards from the Road is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Our theme music is Cherry Blossom Wonders by Kevin MacLeod. And as always, if you like what you hear, subscribe on your audio app of choice. Visit wamcpodcasts.org for more information.